Say D-Day, and most people will think of the Normandy invasion in June of 1944. But well before the epic crossing of the English Channel, there were scores of amphibious assaults in the Pacific. I'm Oliver North, and in this War Stories podcast, you're going to hear the firsthand accounts of Marines, sailors, and airmen who fought in Operation Forager in the Mariana Islands the same month and on the other side of the world from Operation Overlord. 3,700 miles from Hawaii, the Mariana Islands were the main Pacific outpost for the Japanese Empire. Fiercely defended by over 70,000 Japanese troops, the island airfields in Saipan, Guam, and Tinian were must-have pieces of real estate. If taken, swarms of our massive four-engine B-29 bombers would be able to devastate mainland Japan and stop the war machine in its tracks. On these tiny islands, 100,000 soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines faced a determined enemy. The Japanese defenders had been given a simple order, absolutely no surrender. That meant our victory would come at a very high price. This chilling podcast of War Stories will bring you to the white sands of hell, where the voices you hear faced an enemy 4,000 strong in one of their Benzai charges. You'll hear the actual recording of an amphibious landing of Marines hitting the beach, and eyewitness accounts of how and why thousands of Japanese civilians took their own lives at Suicide Gulch. And when you hear legendary Navy fighter ace Alex Vraku describe the Great Marianas Turkey Shoot, where he shot down six Japanese bombers in less than 8 minutes, you may need to fasten your seatbelt and parachute harness.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter's been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/war. That's ZipRecruiter.com/war. One more time, try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/war.
They answered the call.
This is what I consider my payback for Pearl Harbor.
They faced an empire of evil.
But we had heard that they were very cruel and very vicious people.
It was the most ungodly sound imaginable.
And witnessed hell before coming home. The assault on the Mariana Islands. That's coming up on War Stories. This is an Amtrak. In June of 1944, thousands of men boarded amphibian tractors like this one and stormed the beaches of the Mariana Islands. For nearly 5,000 of these soldiers, sailors, and Marines, the ride to Saipan, Guam, and Tinian would be a one-way trip. Good evening, I'm Oliver North. Welcome to War Stories. This is the National Museum of the Pacific War in Fredericksburg, Texas. Say D-Day. Most people think of the Normandy invasion, June 6, 1944. But the term is actually universal. It simply marks the day troops leave their ships and head for shore. That June of 44, almost 8,000 miles from where the Allies breached Hitler's Atlantic Wall, 100,000 U.S. Marines and soldiers prepared for another D-Day against the Japanese Imperial Army. Tonight, crossing the white sands of hell, where the enemy had one simple order, absolutely no surrender. The stock market crash of 1929 marked the beginning of the Great Depression. It was the longest and most severe economic depression ever experienced in the Western world. Born in 1919, Cyril O'Brien grew up in Camden, New Jersey.
What was the depression like for you all?
It's a pretty lousy world. We get a loaf of bread, it was 5 cents. My father used to, The Delaware Bridge was 2 miles. It cost a nickel to go across the Delaware Bridge on a bus. And he saved that nickel and walked over the Delaware Bridge.
While America struggled through the Depression, Japan was building an empire. By the late 1930s, they had made a massive land grab. In their firm and brutal grasp, vast territories ranging from Manchuria and China to the small Mariana Islands of Saipan and Tinian.
Now given a film revelation of Pearl Harbor.
On December 7th, now 22-year-old O'Brien, or Obie as he calls himself, was a paper boy.
I was home, and I got a call from the Courier Post in Camden, New Jersey, and they told me, "Hey, Obie, come on down and sell some extras." I went down and I sold extras.
Just one day after Pearl Harbor, the Japanese seized U.S. territory, the island of Guam. Now they controlled the entire Mariana Islands chain.
The recruiting campaign is in full swing.
How'd you end up in the Marines?
Because they turned me down. That's why I joined them. And they passed me, and they says, "O'Brien, you can't make it. You're less than a half inch too short." And I thought, that's a hell of a reason to turn anybody down. So I went down to the colonel in charge of everything. And I said, "You're not going to turn me down being a half inch too short." He said, "If you're so interested in joining the Marine Corps," he says, "enlist." I said, "Okay." I went down and I enlisted.
Because he wouldn't take you as an officer.
They wouldn't take me as an officer, but they took me as enlisted.
By the thousands, young men signed up for military service. Some were, in fact, just eager boys like California native Rick Spooner, who was just 17.
You went down in Fresno, California, and enlisted?
No. They had turned me down a couple of times and knew who I was. So I got to San Francisco with a new birth certificate. It worked a lot better that way. I was a little underage when I enlisted, but they needed guys.
Had you grown up in the Corps?
No, but I grew up around a lot of Marines as a kid. Pacific Fleet headquarters used to be in California, and as a little boy, I'd see Marines coming back. They'd be wearing their blue as a gun. They were magnificent. To a little kid, that was impressive. So I was captivated by the Corps. I knew nothing about the Marine Corps.
All that changed when 18-year-old Ed Driscoll caught a glimpse of a Marine Corps ad while riding the train to work in Chicago. He signed up in February of 1941.
I noticed a picture up there of something called Marines. And I thought, good Lord, land, sea, and air. That must be a place for adventure.
Actually, most people don't know that they were starting to draft people in 1940.
East Chicago, Indiana native Alex Vrashu was 23 when he began Navy flight training, and he knew it was going to be a long war.
We weren't ready. You know, when we got hurt badly at Pearl Harbor, and we didn't have the carriers, the planes, the squadrons, and we were just training.
I was 16 years old when the Japs hit Pearl Harbor, and naturally, we were all madder than hell. And I wanted to, hell, I would have went then if Mom and Dad would have let me, but we just had this, wanted to get even, I guess, you know how kids are.
Don Swindle got his chance at payback with the Marines. At the ripe old age of 18, he left Indiana for boot camp in California. Afterwards, he was assigned to the 4th Marine Division.
Usually you get a 10-day furlough, but my assignment was the 4th Marine Division, and they were on 72-hour standby, so I never got to come home until the war was over.
The long road home would bring Don Swindle, Rick Spooner, Cyril O'Brien, and Ed Driscoll face-to-face with battle-hardened troops under Japanese War Minister General Hideki Tojo. His nickname, the Razor.
In the Pacific Theater, you had two commanders, two great egos, two different ways of fighting a war and talking about it.
Joe Alexander is a retired Marine Corps colonel and author of Storm Landings.
Chester Nimitz, Fleet Admiral, commanded the Pacific Fleet and had the Central Pacific in his domain. Douglas MacArthur, eventually General of the Armies, had the Southwest Pacific Theater.
At the start of the war, MacArthur had been run out of the Philippines by the Japanese. But by January of 44, his island-hopping campaign
had brought him to the brink of return. He and Nimitz had resolved the question at hand, whether to advance on a single axis or attack the enemy in two places simultaneously.
Nimitz started to listen to MacArthur's claims that he wanted a single axis. He was willing to contribute to MacArthur's approach in New Guinea toward the Philippines. But his boss, Admiral King, on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said no. We're not going to go south. We're going to continue across the Central Pacific. Our next target is the Marianas.
The plan to seize the Marianas was codenamed Operation Forager, and it held a dual purpose for American forces. First, the islands possessed vital airfields located just 1,200 miles from Tokyo. If taken, they could provide bases for new long-range heavy bombers. From there, the Boeing B-29 superfortresses could make the trip to Tokyo in under 6 hours. With a bomb load of up to 20,000 pounds, its destructive potential had no rival in the air.
And the interesting thing here, where the Marines for 40 years have been training to seize advanced naval bases for the fleet, now they were going to the Marianas to seize advanced air bases.
Beyond the airfields, it was hoped that by seizing the islands of Saipan, Guam, and Tinian, the Japanese Navy could be drawn into a decisive battle. Since Midway in 1942, the Japanese had struggled to recover from the crushing loss of four carriers and some 300 aircraft. To avoid another crippling blow, the fleet was in hiding.
The Japanese considered the Marianas their main Pacific outpost. That was within their absolute national defensive zone. It was not to be penetrated. They were to hold there at all costs.
Tojo had promised the Japanese people that no enemy forces would set foot on the Mariana Islands. But to keep that promise, the Japanese Navy would have to come out and fight. Bearing down on the Marianas that June of 44, the boys were combat-hardened and ready to make Tojo eat his words.
What does steak and eggs have to do with amphibious landings? Find out when War Stories continues.
June 1944, Operation Forager was underway, and the U.S. Navy's awesome Fifth Fleet steamed toward the Mariana Islands. Under the command of Admiral Raymond Spruance were 30 carriers, 14 battleships, and over 120 destroyers. All told, nearly 550 ships were converging on the islands of Saipan, Guam, and Tinian. Half a world away, a fleet 10 times larger was beginning the liberation of Europe with the invasion of Normandy.
This is something that was inconceivable to the United States even a half year earlier, that they could launch simultaneous major offensive attacks in both theaters of war. The tide had changed for the Japanese.
Admiral Spruance was tasked with delivering a very precious cargo, the 2nd and 4th Marine Divisions and the Army's 27th Infantry Division, totaling over 100,000 men, and with him, Marine Sergeant Cyril O'Brien, headed for Guam. Ed Driscoll, Don Swindle, and 17-year-old Rick Spooner were destined for a different battlefield.
We were board ship, up on deck. We got our intelligence briefing. I remember the lieutenant talking about it. We're going to seize, occupy, and defend the Mariana Islands. And that didn't register. And then he said, Saipan, Tinian, and Guam. The one you should be most concerned about is Saipan, because that's where you're going.
During their voyage, the men shared scuttlebutt about the enemy.
What did you learn about the Japanese?
They did tell us that these were tough guys, that they ran 20 miles a day.
We just knew that they were little guys.
Well, we had heard that they were very cruel and very vicious people, you know. And they weren't afraid of dying. In fact, they had rather die than they would, you know, let you take them alive.
Saipan was the first objective, just 13 miles long and 6 miles wide. It's roughly the size of Manhattan and home to nearly 30,000 Japanese troops under the command of General Hideyoshi Obata.
On June 14th, after weeks of aerial attacks, U.S. forces began the naval bombardment, pounding the island with tens of thousands of shells.
The preliminary bombardment of Saipan is awesome. Naval gunfire is a beauty to behold if you're on the side of the invading forces. And it's the kind of thing that if you, it's so much overpressure, even from a miss, that will blow your eardrums out.
A lot of smoke from the beach, smoke and flame all up and down the western side of Saipan.
There were fires all over the island. The Navy had been bombarding that thing with the battleship bombardment force. A hell of a job.
After witnessing this softening up, the men knew their D-Day was near. The rumors were confirmed when the mess hall offered up a telltale sign.
On D-Day, all the troops could expect to have a certain meal early in the morning before landing, and that was steak and eggs.
For many of these baby-faced Marines, this meal would be their last.
I think they crossed the line at the line of departure about 8 o'clock in the morning on the 15th of June. That was our D-Day.
The Japanese were mainly expecting an attack from the Americans, from the east. It's the most logical place, and that's where they would have landed, and they had that most well covered by the big guns.
It was more heavily defended on the east side than on the west side, but our landing was on the west side.
And it was no big deal for them to relay their major guns, their field artillery, to the west coast. By the time we came in, they were ready for us.
When you went ashore at H Hour, you came off an LST or an APA?
We were on Amtraks. And those Amtraks were different than what you have today. They were open Amtraks. There was no protection, no cover.
You're down, but you can still see out. You can't hardly get that low, you know. And you can see when they come within 4 or 5 foot of you.
The Amtrak, short for amphibian tractor, held 18 to 20 troops and traveled at the frighteningly slow speed of 5 miles per hour. It was, however, able to drive up onto shore and take Marines inland. But bobbing slowly toward the beach made them vulnerable targets.
Every now and then, in horror of horror, the explosion would kill just about everybody in the troop compartment. Many of our men were hurt badly, and some killed by the bones of the men in front of them, just blown into them by the impact of this terrific explosion.
Although they got knocked out on each side of us, our Amtrak did. Ours got through it, but they come pretty close to it.
Well, there was one off to the right that suddenly burst into flame. They'd taken a hit.
You never forget the sound of an incoming round.
You never do. There's no way you can wipe that out of your memory bank. It was the most ungodly sound imaginable, and I'm going to tell you right here and now, it was like a score of railroad trains 6 feet above you.
It was a short ship-to-shore movement, but it was one that was just reeking with horror for those few minutes before they could get ashore, and then it got worse.
The white sands of hell turn red with American blood. That's next on War Stories. As the sun climbed into the sky on June 15, 1944, the first wave of 150 Amtraks plotted toward the beaches of Saipan. The success of the mission would put Japan's factories, fueling the war machine, within the range of our heavy bombers. As they approached the shoreline, the Marines faced their first serious challenge.
There's a barrier reef around that island, and the Japanese had registered their artillery and anti-boat guns and heavy mortars on the barrier reef.
General Obata's troops, now being led by Yoshitsugu Saito, didn't need to target individual Amtraks. Instead, they opened up with all they had, knowing the Marines would have to slowly pass over the razor-sharp coral reef through a waterfall of fire.
The whole reef exploded. This was the combined first volley from the Japanese. Welcome to Saipan. It was awesome. We lost Amtrak. Some of them were blown completely to pieces.
Do you remember, as you're coming across the reef, did your tracks actually have to engage to get over it, or did you float over it?
Frankly, I was too damn scared to know what the tracks on that thing were doing.
In just 30 minutes, the Marines lost 20 amphibian tractors and suffered hundreds of casualties. But 130 Amtraks made it ashore, though not all of them were in the right place.
The problem was the Navy had laid down a heavy smokescreen, which we were delighted at first, because that would mask our landing. But it also blinded all the drivers. So we wound up landing on the wrong beach.
That can always be a problem in an amphibious assault or any kind of assault.
How far was it from where you were landed to where you had to get to in terms of meters or yards?
It seemed like 5 or 6 miles. I think it might have been a couple of hundred yards. I don't know. Maybe it was only 100 yards. But it was forever as far as we were concerned. We had to run down the white sands of hell is what it amounted to. We were taking some casualties all the time.
We got through this gauntlet of fire. Now, within a matter of the first hour or so, we had 20,000 U.S. Marines ashore.
There was shelling from both sides, from our ships going in, and Japanese returning fire, from aircraft going over, guys hollering, Amtrak noises.
Were you able to dig in?
The little entrenching tools we had were not really designed to go through coral. We needed jackhammers, but you know, when you're scared and someone's shooting at you a whole lot, it's amazing how powerful you can be.
By nightfall on D-Day, the 2nd and 4th Marine Divisions had established their beachhead. The price? Hundreds of dead with another 2,000 casualties. And the Japanese defenders were paying dearly as well.
Could you see any Japanese at that point, other than the dead ones on the
beach? We saw lots of dead Japanese and very few live Japanese.
There were dead Marines laying around on the beach, and as we went in a little farther, there were dead Japanese there.
With daytime temperatures approaching 100 degrees, the sights and sounds of battle were soon joined by the smells.
It's summertime in the South Pacific.
With all those dead folks, you can imagine horrible smells. You take a deep breath, you're almost afraid you're going to get that horrible odor of the dead.
Sweet, sickly stink got in your clothes, in your nostrils, and a smell that I never want to smell again.
As American troops slog across Saipan, they witnessed the pervasive power of propaganda. The horrifying saga of Suicide Gulch is next on War Stories. D plus 12 hours, 15 June 1944. Over 20,000 Marines are hunkered down on the beaches of Saipan. The cost to get there? 2,000 casualties, including hundreds of dead. Just offshore, Admiral Raymond Spruance and the 5th Fleet provided vital supplies and firepower. Without this lifeline, the Marines could have been slaughtered. With just that outcome in mind, Japanese Navy Chief of Staff Admiral Soemu Toyoda upped the ante. He ordered the Mobile Fleet, with its 9 carriers, 5 battleships, and 14 cruisers, to repel the invasion and engage in what would become the largest carrier aviation battle in history.
By Admiral Raymond Spruance, he made the decision that he would defend the invasion force. He would send his fast carriers, Mark Mitcher's Task Force 58, to deal with the Japanese mobile fleet.
From 300 miles away, Japanese Admiral Jizaburo Ozawa ordered his carrier-based dive bombers and torpedo planes to zero in on Admiral Mark Mitcher's Task Force 58. 10,000 feet above the Mariana Islands, some 1,000 American and Japanese planes engaged in the greatest dogfight ever. Lieutenant Junior Grade Alex Vrashu already had an impressive 12 air-to-air kills, but he would soon bag more.
When I spotted 3 specks out there, I said, no, I've got to be more than 3.
his instincts were right.
There were a good 50, of them in that group. And I thought to myself, boy, this is the once-in-a-lifetime dream that you can have. Then I pulled up on the other side. I came down on one and burnt him. And as he was going down, I just lowered my wing and I got in position for the second one, got him. As they were going into a deep spiral, heading on down, and on, I say I started to feel a little sorry for the bastard, but not for long. So that made three. And then I looked up ahead and I saw a string of three of them. And I worked my way up, and by that time we were getting to the outer screen of our own forces. And you could see some 5-inch shells are starting to open up on there. You dare what you have to dare.
Forced to chase the Japanese pilots into his own fleet fire, Alex let loose with his Hellcat 650 caliber machine guns. He bagged kills number 4 and 5 as they started their bomb runs.
So when I got the fifth one, I had to race to get the second one, which had started his dive already, and there was one ahead of him too on the thing. But I got the one and he blew up. I must have hit his bomb.
Brashu had knocked down 6 Japanese fighters in less than 8 minutes, and he'd end the battle as the Navy's top-ranking ace.
It was over as fast as it started. You know, I looked back, all I could see was pieces of plane burning, things falling, you know, burning flames on the water. It was, I considered, my payback for Pearl Harbor.
The American pilots took down 369 Japanese planes, losing 22 of their own. This most lopsided air-to-air victory in history would become forever known as the Great Marianas Turkey Shoot.
Lieutenant Gerald Saito, senior Army commander of Imperial Japanese forces on Saipan, knew that the Japanese fleet was coming. That was his salvation. When the American fleet, the full fleet, reappeared on the horizon, he knew not only was his battle not going to end well, that it had no possible conclusion but his own death and defeat.
It was the end of the Japanese carrier aircraft.
With no outside threat remaining, PFC Rick Spooner and his brother Marines were joined by the Army's 27th Infantry Division to mop up the remaining defenders. While an American victory seemed close at hand by July 7th, the remaining Japanese defenders wouldn't go quietly.
Banzai attack was the last card, the desperation. And use any weapon we've got. If you've got a grenade, great. If you've got a spear, that's good too.
The Japanese again made the mistake of attacking in rushes, and that cost them dearly.
Well, they would win simply by killing as many of us as possible. Before you give up your lives, take 7 of the American devils with you. And they had in excess of 4,000 men that were going to participate in that. And they were dedicated.
It's not just a willingness to give their lives.
Oh, it's an eagerness.
They intend to.
Yeah, they did.
But eagerness was met with a hail of fire. In the end, more than 4,000 Japanese troops gave their all for the emperor.
There were Japanese who had been told to be fearful of the Americans, that we were going to eat them or something like that. Save themselves, they had to destroy themselves.
With American victory certain, Saipan became the scene of one of the most heartbreaking moments in World War II. To save themselves from the feared Americans, many of Saipan's Japanese citizens did the unthinkable.
There's a phrase that comes out of Saipan, a term, suicide gulch.
The Japanese convinced their civilians to take their lives because they told them we would do terrible things to them. Now, many of them detonated grenades in their bellies, but one of the things they did, they would jump over the cliff.
Even as American translators promised them safe harbor, they continued to jump.
And a few times you'd see a woman with a baby in her arms or strapped on her back starting for the cliff, and then she'd stop and listen as though she was going to come in. And some Japanese soldier would fire his rifle at her.
Yeah, you think, why? Why would they do that to their own people, you know?
Of Saipan's roughly 20,000 civilians, almost half were dead.
On July 9, 1944, the island was declared secure. That very day, the disgraced Yoshitsugu Saito took his own life and was laid to rest with full military honors. Nearly 30,000 Japanese defenders lay dead on Saipan. The American forces were also scarred by the battle. 3,000 Marines and soldiers had lost their lives, with another 13,000 wounded. With victory on Saipan, attention turns to Guam and Tinian. Just ahead, the rare recording of an actual amphibious assault. By July 20th, 1944, attention had already shifted from Saipan to Guam, the second jewel of the Mariana Island campaign. Defended by over 18,000 Japanese troops under General Takeshi Takeshina, the landings looked like so many others. But this was not an invasion.
They're out to recapture the first bit of American-owned land seized by the Japs. Guam in the far Pacific.
This was a liberation. This is what's special about Guam.
The island of Guam had been seized by the Japanese. There were enormous abuses of the population. Did you know any of that before?
Yes, I did. I didn't know it before. But I'll tell you, and I could have walked over to that far and seen bodies of the, there were five or six Chamorros, their heads cut off.
By the summer of 44, 25-year-old Cyril Obi O'Brien was a Marine correspondent. He was basically an embedded reporter with a rank of sergeant.
Do you know why the Marine Corps kept them sergeants and enlisted? So they could rapport with the men.
Now, almost 1,000 days after the Japanese invaded Guam, the 3rd Marine Division, the 1st Marine Provisional Brigade, and the 77th Army Division were taking it back.
Tell me about the landing on Guam.
At night, we pulled up to Guam, and the star shells reaching out, showing these hills. Star shells, their shells and our shells, lighting up, light illuminating it all. And I'm looking at it, and I said, oh, my God. I'm going to be in there tomorrow morning.
The beach looks as though it's practically on fire.
This is a recording of the Guam landings made by Marine Corps combat correspondent Sergeant Alvin Josephi.
There go American dive bombers going down on the beach, back of the beach. We can see the beach very clearly now. Night sand. I'll tell you one thing I'm thinking right now of my home, my wife, and my little daughter.
What I remember him about is he came in on the landing carrying this heavy radio equipment, describing minute by minute, step by step, the approach to the beach. One man got here. Mortars are falling into water. There's a machine gun over there. We're getting close.
We're very close now. What's the matter? Hey, spread out! One Marine lying on his back with blood pouring out of him into the water. The whole beach is just piled with Marines. They're flat down, hugging the earth, dug in, the shot holes.
I landed with an assault wave. The assault wave had one advantage. We came in on Amtraks, tracked vehicles. It was like a taxi. They took you right up and put you on the beach. And we jumped over the side. So the first thing I thought about was what? Safety. I jumped into a shell hole.
By the end of D-Day, most of their assault forces were well off the beach, over the initial sand dunes and low-lying hills, and proceeding inland. It was going to get difficult after that.
General Hideyoshi Obata, the commander of all troops defending the Marianas, had been stuck on Guam since the landing on Saipan. He was killed by American forces, saving him from the humiliation of yet another defeat.
You're armed with a carbine at this time or a pistol?
Oh, most of the time I had a pistol.
45.
And all the shooting's going on and that kind of thing. And I think I'm writing the Great War story, and I'm typing it there, and all of a sudden, damn it, mortars start to come in. You get mad as hell. Not that you'd get killed, but they were interfering with your writing.
How many days from the day you'd write the story would it appear in the paper?
A week. About a week.
Folks back home had plenty of war stories to read, and just 3 days after the Guam landings, it was Tinian's turn to feel the weight of American combat forces.
The only forces available to Admiral Spruance to attack Tinian were the survivors, the two Marine divisions and the Army division who had landed and fought the 3.5 weeks of Saipan.
It was within artillery distance, not too many miles. You could see one island from the other easily for the Marine Corps to get going, go to the next one.
We were absolutely ecstatic that we were permitted to go aboard ship. After all that time on Saipan.
Had you had a shower yet?
No, none of us had changed clothes or had a shower. Water was too precious. You drank your water.
When we got back aboard LST, they had this ice water fountain. But that was something, a drink of cold water was just out of this world.
Despite the horror and hardship of combat, compassion can still be found. Battle-hardened troops rescue a child. Next on War Stories. July 24, 1944. More than 8,000 Japanese defenders were dug in on Tinian, waiting for the Americans to enter their gun sights. Like the earlier landings on Saipan and Guam, Admiral Spruance's battleships shelled the island. Planes destroyed targets and the Marines loaded on their landing craft and Amtraks. But all was not as it seemed.
The 2nd Marine Division conducted the most successful feint of the war, a false landing, a decoy landing, off of the coast of Tinian Town, where the most obvious beaches were. The Japanese commander opened fire. In fact, they were so effective with their counter-battery fire that they hit the battleship Colorado 30 or 40 times. The Japanese commander was delighted. He radioed to Tokyo that we've repulsed the American landing. And of course, it was all a ruse. There were some other ships, smaller ones, LSTs, kind of clustered up at the north. They looked like support ships. That was the main show.
The Japanese were caught by surprise that we landed there, so we didn't have any great difficulty.
Tinian was the first tactical use of napalm bombs, and they would explode and burn and suffocate.
I tell you, that napalm saved a lot of American lives on all of those islands.
And it was very useful in working in caves. If you put enough in there, it would burn up the oxygen, and the occupants of the cave would suffer from that.
An old Marine once said, "War is horrible. In order to win, you must endure horrible things, and you must do them." The battles for Saipan, Tinian, and Guam were no exceptions. But even in the midst of the darkness, there were moments of hope.
Four or five little Japanese women came out of the cave. So the Marines went up and got them and brought them down. We had to cross the stream. And these Marines picked these little women up in their arms so they wouldn't have to walk through the water and carry them over. They were thinking of their mothers, their sisters, their daughters. Isn't that something?
That's Marines. No greater enemy, no greater friend.
That's right.
This particular afternoon, one of our platoons had discovered a cave, and two Japanese soldiers came running out of it. Then they heard a child crying inside, and they went in and found this little girl, probably 2.5 or 3 years old, and brought her out of the cave. And she was very dirty, and so after we got her clean as well as we could, I took a new skivvy shirt that I had in my pack. I put it on her, and it came all the way down to her ankles. I don't know if she's alive today, but I hope she is.
You're watching War Stories on the Fox News Channel. Stay tuned. By
By early August of 44, the Japanese defenders on Tinian and Guam joined Saipan in defeat. America now controlled the vital Mariana Islands.
And now the Stars and Stripes wave over Guam once again.
Tojo himself, at the end of the war, before he was executed for war crimes, said that he felt in his heart that they could not win after the loss of the Marianas.
But the soldiers and Marines weren't headed home. As B-29s streamed north to strike at Japan, most figured victory was years away, and the long road home would wind through Tokyo.
Well, anything we heard about shortening the war was really important. The phrase that we always used was Golden Gate in 48, or it's going to be a long war.
The prospect of leading massive forces into the homeland of Japan was daunting. Not because of the casualties that America would have to pay, but because of the destruction of that civilization. There would have been millions and millions of Japanese civilians who would have died.
Two atomic bombs were dropped in August of 1945, making the impending invasion unnecessary. September 1945, the Japanese signed the official surrender document aboard the USS Missouri. The war in the Pacific was finally over. Rick Spooner stayed in the Marines and retired in 1972 as a major. He owns and operates the Globe and Laurel restaurant just outside the gates of Quantico. Ed Driscoll also stayed in the Corps, retiring as a colonel in 1981. The military also held its grasp on Alex Vrashu. He retired from the Navy in 1963 and went on to a successful career with Wells Fargo. Cyril O'Brien continued to work as a reporter, helping Americans understand everything from politics in Washington to applied physics at Johns Hopkins. Don Swindle left the Marines after the war and went home to Indiana and back to work. He still works full-time as a security guard.
It was something that had to be done, and somebody had to do it. Really and truthfully, my generation have had the worst of it and the best of it.
It took more than 100,000 soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines to seize Saipan, Tinian, and Guam that terrible summer of 44. 27,000 of them were killed or wounded. They'd all been told that victory in the Mariana Islands would shorten the war. With victory, they accomplished their mission and did indeed hasten the end of mankind's bloodiest contest. One veteran of the campaign said he couldn't imagine going through this hell and not going on to lead a productive life. He did so, and so did hundreds of thousands like him. Theirs is a war story that deserves to be told. I'm Oliver North. Good night.